Bruce, welcome to Atwood Unleashed. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you very much for having me.
It's our pleasure. We have to follow Baby Ziggy now, so it's a tall order. But
easy.
I know. I believe we can give it our best shot for sure. But yeah, thank you for joining us. It's a fascinating topic that we're going to be discussing, and you know, quite macabre. So I'm kind of tentatively looking forward to getting into the details. But maybe you could just explain a little bit about who you are and what you do, please.
Sure. Well, my name is Bruce Ackman. I served as the special agent in charge of the United States Department of Veterans Affairs, Office of Inspector General, Criminal Investigation Division for the Northeast United States. And what that rather long title all means is that I was responsible for all the major criminal investigations involving the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs in the Northeast. That's from West Virginia to Maine. And that include all the veterans hospitals and outpatient clinics and other services they provided. So it covered hundreds of thousands of employees and millions of veterans here in the United States.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, just trying to read some of your titles out in the, and your experience out in the intro at the beginning was a tall order for sure. So, I mean, What keeps somebody in that line of work then, really? Because to the average civilian like me, that we get to almost opt out of the dark belly of society. A lot of us never get to see any of the more horrific sides of humanity. But this is kind of something you were doing on a day-to-day basis. What's the mentality there that can help, well, enable someone to carry out that role?
Well, you know, I always felt honored, actually, to be in both law enforcement that was dedicated to helping our nation's heroes. So that was sort of a real guide for me because, I mean, my dad was a vet. I served in the Army Reserve. And I always felt that connection that everything I was doing was really helping people that dedicated their lives to helping our country. So that sort of kept me going even during some of the darker times. And there were darker times, you know, during the course of the investigations that I did for over 25 years.
Tell me a little bit about medical serial killers. And obviously people will be familiar with what a serial killer is. You know, it seems like there's a renewed obsession with this topic, actually. Documentaries on this topic are doing well, you know, series, podcasts. People seem fascinated by this kind of dark aspect of humanity. But what's a medical serial killer?
Well, medical serial killer is a otherwise medical professional who actually is intent on murdering patients. And when I talk about medical serial killers, I'm not referring to like a Dr. Kevorkian who is just trying to aid patients that were very, very ill to maybe a peaceful death. I'm talking about people in the medical profession who are actually intent on murdering their patients. Now, I have to preface my remarks by saying that the overwhelming majority of healthcare professionals are the most honest, hardworking, dedicated people you would ever want to meet in your life. That is why medical serial killers are so successful, because no one expects them to be in that universe of such wonderful, caring people, people who have taken an oath to save lives, who have dedicated themselves to saving lives. Who's going to believe that someone in that wonderful group of people has actually dedicated themselves to taking lives? Look, if you're looking for a murderer and that murderer is in organized crime, or that murderer is an outlaw motorcycle gang, well, you're not going to be surprised. But who's going to really think that a murderer, someone intent on killing, is actually working in a hospital? And that is one reason why they are so, so very successful. Because, look, everybody goes to a hospital at some point in our lives. And when you hear about when you hear about your regular serial killers, maybe they kill, six or seven people. Well, you know what? They're actually amateurs compared to my medical serial killers. The average kills maybe 20, 30 people. I mean, you know, Harold Shipman in England, he allegedly killed over 300 people. Yeah. Niles Hogel in Germany, perhaps the same. So the medical serial killers are, they work in an environment with people who have dedicated their lives, and they actually have a very difficult time in believing that their coworkers are intentionally killing someone. Not to mention the fact that people in the hospital are in the hospital because they're very sick. And a lot of things could naturally go wrong with them, particularly if you're in the ICU. So if a patient dies in the ICU, I mean the intensive care unit, more than likely, the reason is going to be they died as a result of their natural disease processes, not by somebody killing them. So that built-in excuse is there already. And this is one of the reasons why medical serial killers are so successful, and it takes so many years to investigate, capture them, and prove that they actually murdered their patients.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really interesting point you make about the kind of plausible deniability in an ICU situation. And it seems to me in a lot of ways, obviously, these serial killers don't want to be found. You mentioned Harold Shipman, for instance. And I'm just wondering, what are they getting out of this for them? What's the psychology that you think motivates this kind of thing? Is it a kind of sexual gratification? Is it something else?
Well, I can tell you one size does not fit all.
Sure.
But and I'm not a psychiatrist or a psychologist, but I'll give you my 30 years of experience of investigating these cases. I find that the number one reason is something called Munchausen syndrome by proxy. And what that Munchausen syndrome is when a person will intentionally harm themselves and then go into a hospital and they're looking for attention, for care, because they don't receive that attention and care at home. Munchausen syndrome by proxy is when sometimes a mother will intentionally harm a child, bring that child into the hospital, and show the staff what a caring, loving parent they are, how concerned they are about their child, when in fact they actually harm their child to begin with just to get the attention. So Munchausen syndrome by proxy is something that we saw with Lucy Letby, something that is really detailed in my book about a nurse, Kristen Gilbert. Kristen Gilbert was a nurse at the Northampton VA. In fact, she actually looks a lot like Lucy Letby, which is kind of scary.
Strange coincidence, yeah.
It really is. And in fact, if you recall, with Lucy Letby, when a code was called, her boyfriend, this other doctor, would actually show up, and there would be like a social interaction between Lucy Letby and the doctor at the ICU. Well, the same thing happened with Kristen Gilbert. When a code was called, her boyfriend would come in and they would interact during the code. In fact, witnesses testified there was actually like some grab ass going on between the two of them during the code. So it actually became sort of a sexual experience for them. But why do they do this? Well, this is what happens. Sometimes they're bored. They're not getting any attention at home. They're the member of the family that nobody pays attention to. Their social lives are usually not that great. So now they have an opportunity to show the world and to show their coworkers how talented they are, how compassionate and caring they are. But they can't do that in a regular nursing setting, they feel. So they have to cause a code. And we actually call them code junkies. They intentionally put a patient into a code, and a code is a very exciting procedure because all of a sudden the crash cart comes in and doctors and nurses coming in. Sometimes people from security come in. It's the most exciting part of any nurse's job is when a code is called. And like Kristen Gilbert, she would excel during codes. If you looked at her evaluation, she was an average nurse except when it came to codes. Then she was an outstanding nurse, an A-plus nurse. And we have seen this in other cases around the world. So it gave her that opportunity all of a sudden to have attention, all of a sudden to people look at her who never looked at her before, who praise her, who never praised before. And that great, great need for attention is what drove her to cause this code and to essentially kill people. Now, that's just one explanation, and it doesn't fit all. Some other people, Like the very first case I had at Dr. Swango, who killed about 60 people throughout the world, including a number of our nation's heroes here in the United States. He just craved the power of life and death over an individual. I mean, this gave him the ultimate power when otherwise he really had no power. And this is very common. And in fact, there's a statement. There was a famous medical serial killer in the United States called Donald Harvey. And they asked, hey, Donald, why did you kill all these patients? And I want to read to you what he said. He said, well, people controlled me for 18 years, and then I controlled my own destiny. I controlled other people's lives, whether they lived or died. I had that power to control. After I didn't get caught for the first 15, excuse me? Yeah, the first 15, nobody even questioned in that hospital that they were murders. He says, I thought it was my right. I appointed myself judge, prosecutor, and jury, so I played God. And that's his words, not my words. And this is what I've seen. I've seen a number of cases of this Munchausen syndrome by proxy, and I've also seen a number of cases where people finally have this power. They possess this power that they never, ever had before. And that to them is just thrilling. So what do they do now? It's interesting. So they had the power of life and death. They had that excitement of the code and actually killing people. But are they done then? No, they're not done then, because what about the families of the victims? Can I have a second bite of excitement here? Can I have a second excitement? Not only the first excitement is when I killed people, and I'm so much smarter than the staff and the doctors here because they never suspected anything. So you know what? I'm going to contact the family. Michael Swango, after he murdered the patients, he used to call up the family and go into great detail about Dad's last half hour on Earth, how he suffered, how he tried to save him. It was all bull, all right? But this was his second bite of excitement. Lucy Letby, if you recall, had a lot of interaction with the families, right?
Yeah.
That was her second bit of excitement. It wasn't just the code with her boyfriend and all the attention she got. Now she got attention from the families. In fact, the families were shocked, weren't they? They were shocked when they learned that Lucy Letby actually murdered their child, because they thought Lucy Letby was this wonderful, caring nurse that was so attentive to them. See, that's their second bite of excitement. The first bite is the kill. The second bite is the family. It's a really, really terrible, terrible thing. We had a serial killer here on Long Island. The trial is still going on right now. And what he would do is, after he murdered — this wasn't a doctor, though — he murdered these call girls, but after he murdered them, he would grab their cell phone, call up the family of the girl he just murdered, ask for them, knowing, of course, they were dead, and then harassing the family, just harassing the family. This was his second bite of excitement. It's not just enough for the kill, that you have to have a second bite, which is going after the victim's family. It's a terrible, terrible thing.
Wow, there's a lot there, Bruce. Thank you for that. That was very eye-opening. And I'm just trying to kind of delineate between, say, someone like Letby, who would contact the family and interact with the family, but under the guise of compassion and empathy. I think she'd send them kind of sympathy cards and
yes,
take interest in their social media activity and take keepsakes and things like that. Yes. Whereas this other guy who you said was murdering, like, all girls, as you put it, was, you know, actively taunting the family in a sense. So, that, I mean, there's a difference there in mentality, although the behavior is fairly similar.
Yes, you know what? The end, it's not about the victim. They couldn't care about the victim. It's what the incident does for them personally. The excitement, the thrill, sometimes a sexual excitement, it's all what it does for them. The victim is just a means to the end.
Just want to ask you about, sorry, go ahead.
Greater, you know, hospitals where people are incredibly sick. Look, think about it. You go into a hospital, you're not feeling yourself. You just want to get better. You don't even question, How many people even start questioning the doctors and nurses? You just put your lives in their hands, okay? And understandably, because 99.999% of the staff just want to help you. They want you to get better. But if somebody is in that situation and they could take advantage of it, it's just incredible. And also, even when you look at your own country, the last place police want to do an investigation is in a hospital. Why? For a number of reasons. One, they don't really understand the law. What documents do we need a subpoena for? What documents do we need a court order for? Where are their cameras allowed? Where are the documents? This is so confusing to me. Second thing is they'll hear from the hospital management. Well, thank you very much, officer, for your concerns. You know, we were as concerned as you were. So we appointed a board of our very, very best doctors and nurses to look at these cases. And we came out with the determination that all these patients expired as a direct result of their natural disease processes. Now, if you want to continue that investigation, officer, well, knock yourself out. But we assure you that our team of medical professionals have looked into this, and that's the correct conclusion. And how many police departments who are overworked and overburdened as is are just going to say, thank you very much, Mr. President of the hospital. We appreciate that. We'll close this case and go on to the next. And that's another reason why medical serial killers kill so many people. And not just in one hospital, by the way. Not just in one hospital. There's a famous case in America, Nurse Cullen. Nurse Charles Cullen worked in about 10 different hospitals. Hospital one suspected something, but never said anything to hospital two, who suspected something, that never said anything to hospital three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, not until hospital 10. And then when the police went back to all the hospitals, did those hospitals cooperate with the police? No, they did everything they could to try to protect the reputation of their hospital and not to admit that they knew something was going wrong, but they were so happy that Charles Cullen left to hospital four, five, and six, that they're not going to call the police to say what their suspicions were in the other hospitals. And this is another reason why medical serial killers kill so many people and get away with it for so long.
That's a really great point. I mean, that rings true in a much smaller degree, doesn't it? It's the Lucy Letby case where people had brought this to the attention of the superiors, and it was actually the people who brought this to the attention of the superiors were disciplined at the time and actually made to apologize to her, because the idea of a scandal is terrible optics, isn't it? So I wanted to get your opinion on something a little left field, actually, which is tangentially related, I suppose, and it's obviously to a lesser degree, but I don't know if you recall, a while back it was revealed that a surgeon in a hospital, and I can't remember if this was the States or in the UK, had been kind of leaving his initials on people's organs internally, a little calling card. And although that's not in the same bracket as serial killer, it's kind of almost there in the kind of realm of attention, abuse of power, lording it over people.
Yes, I recall that. I definitely recall that. That was terrible. It was terrible. You know, it's not just those cases or murder cases. In Columbia University Medical Center in the United States, a OBGYN sexually assaulted about 250 women. The hospital defended him and defended him and defended him. Even after he got arrested, not until he was finally convicted. The victims meant nothing to them. They only cared about the reputation of the hospital. And I'll give you my opinion on this, all right? This is my opinion. Unless and until some hospital managers are held criminally liable for aiding and abetting these murders or sexual assaults, this will continue, because there's no financial incentive for hospital managers to call the police, to do the right thing. The financial incentive for them is to do whatever they can to make this go away. to hide it, to have this person move on because, and they will point to this one particular case, for instance. In my book, in Kristen Gilbert, all right, Kristen Gilbert was found guilty of murdering five of our nation's heroes. Two nurse whistleblowers, very brave whistleblowers, came forward, and they told us about this, okay? When these whistleblowers returned to the hospital, do you think they were treated as heroes? Uh-uh, just the opposite. You know what their coworkers said to them? What the hell did you do? You brought law enforcement here. You destroyed the reputation of the hospital. You know, when people drive by the hospital now, you know what they say? Oh, that's where that serial killer was. They don't say, that's where they save all these lives. That's where they have all these wonderful nurses and doctors. You should have kept your mouth shut. You shouldn't have said a thing. And you should have just, we should have just gotten rid of her. Why did you have to call law enforcement? That's the kind of response that happens all over the world, whether it be sexual assault cases, whether it be murder cases. There has never been, to my knowledge, a successful criminal prosecution of the managers that aided and abetted these murders. Now, maybe the law doesn't allow it, then we should change the law. But until managers realize that they themselves could be prosecuted for allowing this madness to continue, it will continue. That's my personal opinion.
No, that's a great point. Accountability is a huge issue with this. And obviously, avenues for people to whistleblow and be protected. I suppose a lot of people will instinctively understand the dynamic of people targeting the vulnerable and preying on them for their own means, whether it be financial, sexual, or, you know, attention seeking, whatever. I think it's a little harder to understand when you place it in the context of having to have spent all that time studying for your medical degree and getting qualified. I mean, this is a very expensive pathway. It's a lot of time and effort. It's not something you can just wing. You have to be very dedicated to it. How do we explain that, that these people are quite clearly capable, people who can attain and seek and gain qualifications, kind of behaving in ways that on the face of it appear very stupid?
Well, you know what? I don't think most medical serial killers go to medical school with the intention of becoming medical serial killers. I think they really go to medical school with the intention of being good nurses or doctors. And then things happen in their lives that caused this change. It's the same thing with lawyers who embezzle money from their clients, you know, accountants who embezzle money. I don't think they studied accountancy for the most part. There may be a few exceptions, you know, but I think most of them actually started out with the best of intentions. And then things happen to them emotionally, psychologically. Sometimes it's drug induced, sometimes it's not. You know, but I think many of them start out trying to do the right thing, and then things change in their lives, and it goes downhill from there.
What's the dynamic between these people and law enforcement then? Because obviously we've talked about the dynamic of the kind of having power over the vulnerable individual and kind of, you know, sort of gaslighting family members and using them for their own gain. But there's also this idea as well, isn't it, that I'm too smart to get caught, I'm getting away with something quite big here. What's this kind of fascination they have with perhaps getting one step ahead of the police?
Well, it's actually totally part of the thrill. You know, there are some other serial killers who have actually taunted the police, you know, who have sent police letters and emails and things like that. But look, not only if I'm a medical serial killer, am I smarter than the police, but I'm smarter than all these MDs, you know, with all these degrees and honorariums, all of that. I'm much smarter than they are because I've been able to kill so many people. They actually defending me. So the police are like nothing. They're not even on my list of people to worry about. If I could convince sometimes world-renowned medical professionals that the patients died as the result of their natural disease processes and not from something I did. Wow. That says a lot about me, I think.
Well, given your experience of all these cases and all the observations you've made, what's your gut feeling in terms of whether or not these people will eventually get caught? Or do you think there's good reason to believe there are people out there getting away with it right now and we'll never find out?
Oh, boy. You know, that's something I dwell on periodically, because I'm sure there's only... You know how most of these cases start? Most of these cases start like this. Every time Nurse Bruce is on duty, the death rate goes up. Nurse Bruce takes a vacation, the death rate goes down. Well, that doesn't mean that Nurse Bruce is a serial killer, does it? Maybe Nurse Bruce has the most complex cases. Maybe there's legitimate reason for that. But you know something else? See, these patients weren't expected to expire when they did. Many of them were actually improving only to get a visit from this Nurse Bruce and then to die unexpectedly. But look how many people have to expire before that red flag is actually raised. And then management will refer to it as a statistical anomaly that so many people are dying under Bruce's care. Well, how would you like to be a statistical anomaly, or have someone in your family be a statistical anomaly? But that's how these cases start. And they don't start until there is a unfortunate large number of suspicious deaths. More often than not, one or two suspicious deaths are just written off to natural disease processes. You know, and even when you look at the death certificates, my God, they all read alike. They all read like myocardial infarction or some kind of heart-related ailment. It's a catch-all. And many times they're even signed by people who never even saw the patient, not even by the examining doctor. So the death certificate means nothing. And even if the hospital does an autopsy, when a hospital does an autopsy, which is very rare because nobody pays for autopsies anymore, but if the hospital should do an autopsy, it's not a forensic autopsy like we see on the crime shows. It's more of a confirmatory autopsy. Could Bruce Sackman have expired from one or more of his natural disease processes? Yeah, that's why he's in the ICU. You know, the first time I looked at a veteran's medical records, the file was so thick, I didn't know you could be alive and have this much wrong with you, and I first have to prove murder? Think about that. Think about how hard that is. So one detective, and I don't care if you're the reincarnation of Sherlock Holmes, cannot do these cases him or herself. It takes a team of people and a lot of money, because you have to do a lot of expensive lab tests. Sometimes you almost have to create a new lab test if you're looking for one particular drug where that lab test may not even exist. Now, I was with the federal government, so we had the money. But if you're some small police department that's barely keeping the lights on as is, and you're told by the president of the hospital that there's nothing there, are you going to continue the investigation? You're going to say, thank you, Mr. President. Thank you for that report. We'll close out the case and go on to the next. And that's why they get away with so many murders.
Well, Bruce, despite the subject matter, this has been wonderful to hear from you. And it's absolutely fascinating as a topic. Maybe you could let our audience know where they can find more of your work. Where can they find out more about you?
Sure. Well, the book is Behind the Murder Curtain. There's a website by the same name. It's a fast read. Everything in the book is 100% true and accurate. It's never been challenged. And you will read about doctors and nurses who murdered their patients and why they murdered them and what the red flags are that hospitals should look for when things like this happen. And there are a couple of other interesting stories in there as well, including one about a doctor who put people into research knowing that they didn't actually meet what they call the what they call the criteria for the study. All right, there's what they call criteria that allows you in the study and criteria that keeps you out of the study. So he would alter their medical records to make it look that they actually qualified for the records, give them a story that it was going to save their lives and they all died because they never should have been in the study to begin with. That's in the book, along with some other interesting cases as well.
I'll be adding that to my list for sure, Bruce. Thank you very much for joining us. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
Lovely to speak to you. Take care.
Bye-bye.